Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are about to listen to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with my special guest, Stephen Fry. It's very exciting. It's all free to listen to, which is lovely. But if you want to see what's going on, as well as hear it, and believe me, the height differential between me and Stephen Fry should be enough to be funny for an hour and a half on its own, then you can go to www.gofasterstripe.com/podcast, where you can either buy just this episode for £3.50 or the whole series of at least 7 podcasts for £15, which is very good value, with one from Chris Addison. Next week will be John Lloyd, Mary Beard. There's lots of more big names to come. And so please, if you want to donate some money, do go and pay for the video. But otherwise, just enjoy this for nothing. Thanks for listening. Now the actual podcast will start. It's just about to start in a minute. I'm just going to make you wait for it for a bit because you haven't paid anything. All right, it can start now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Welcome a man who, if he becomes Doctor Who, will we tell everyone what his name is straight away. It's Richard Herring! Hello! Thank you! Hello! Welcome to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as all the cool kids are calling it, Rehelestapa! Oh, it's good to be back. Oh, where's I Love London gone? He loves London so much he's had to go out and look at London. Oh, we had such fun before the show. I'm filming today. If anyone gets something, we've got a few of these people on film. Those are the butlers. That man's a nuclear physicist. Am I allowed to show your face or will you get official secrets? It's fine. It's called David. He could create a bomb that could destroy the world. So it's lovely to be here. Doctor Who is going to be a new Doctor Who, as I call him. I think it should be me, and if it is me, I'm throwing my hat into the ring. I tried to become Pope, they didn't want that. So I'm going to go to be the Doctor Who, and that's what I insist on being called. If I am Doctor Who, I'm going to use my TARDIS to travel back in time and have sex with every single assistant he's ever had. Especially Adric. Especially. I'm going to just bum him just as the spaceship's crashing into the planet Earth to kill the dinosaurs. Then he won't mind dying so much. I liked Adric. Do you like Adric? What do you mean you don't? Sorry, I meant to be filming you. Pull that. Do that reaction. Do you like Adric? There you go. That is. There's a man sitting on the front row of my audience who doesn't even know who Adric is. That's how. much my audience has changed today. We have a big star guest, I guess. This is the Slytherin notebook. Yeah, if you were watching the video of this, you'd be able to see that. That's the famous Slytherin. I'm in the Slytherin house if I'm in Harry Potter, because I don't like anything to do with Harry Potter, so I bought this to show J.K. Rowling. Actually, it's going to be a bit embarrassing if I don't like anything to do with Harry Potter. So my guest reads all the books now. The news today, or two or three days ago, if you're watching this on video, is that a lot of 5 to 8 year old children think that fish fingers are from pigs. A lot of 5 to 8 year olds think that bread is made out of meat. This isn't really news, is it? A lot of 5 to 8 year olds think that Father Christmas exists. Can't really have a go. Yeah, a lot of people 5 to 8, they don't really know fuck all about it, and they're stupid. They think if they put your tooth under your pillow, a fairy will come and give you some money. Fucking idiots. How about having a go at the 5 to 8 year olds? How about having a go at the men in the House of Lords who are too fucking stupid to realise they're going to get caught if they try and get bungs from people? Sorry, that's got a little bit political. I'm trying to show off. And Michael Douglas has revealed that cunnilingus gave him throat cancer. So there's a good excuse for you fellas. But also cunnilingus cures throat cancer as well. That's what he genuinely said this. It wasn't the drinking and the smoking that gave him throat cancer. It was Catherine Zeta-Jones's clitoris, is what he's saying. I think he's just showing off. What he's saying is he's just going on the news going, I really like giving cunnilingus, that's so... Hey, ladies. I think that's what he's going. And Nick Ross has said a lot of things. You know, when it first started, I thought, it's good that someone challenges that. Oh, no, it isn't. It's good that we should at least have a discussion. Oh, no, we shouldn't. Glick Ross says of child porn, if someone says to you, would you like to see what all the fuss is about, I probably would say yes. What all the fuss is about? I think what the fuss is about is that children are being forced to have sex with adults. Yeah, I'd like to see what all the fuss is about. He said some terrible things. He said that provocatively dressed women are like banks storing sacks of cash by the door. In that, if you stole that money, it would be illegal. I think there's that. You would be breaking the law, even if they put it by the door. I know, he said West Indians are more likely to mug people. You can't argue with that. That's just... Because why? Because, West Indians have some extra... No, they don't. Anyway, we need to crack on at that controversial point. I didn't mean it. I was kind of joking. Don't come back, Stephen Fry. So we weren't quite sure he was going to make it to the theatre, but he always makes it to the theatre. That is what you have to remember about Stephen Fry. Will you please welcome my guest? He is best known as the judge from Spice World. You'll remember him from that. And, of course, Armitage Blair from Woof. Will you please welcome Stephen Fry, ladies and gentlemen? Stephen Fry. Oops. Thank you very much, Stephen. Thank you. It's bloody Stephen Fry. How did we get him? How did we get you? So, do you remember much about being the judge in Spice World? That's what people will want to hear. I know everyone will ask you about that.
It's the proudest moment of my life. My only excuse, and it's the excuse every single person who was in that film, except obviously the Spice Girls themselves, gave as we clustered in little knots outside the stage saying, why the fuck are we doing this? was that we had godchildren and nieces and nephews for whose love we could guarantee forever by getting signed photographs from all the girls. And that's basically why I did it. And at the end of the day, they all signed it. And Victoria said she had read my second novel, Anonymous. I worship her. I don't know. She presumably eats books instead of food. But she was very, very kind, and I refuse to apologise.
I met the Spice Girls. I met the Spice Girls the same day I met Richard and Judy. I haven't met many famous people. I'm quite excited, Steve. Off of Twitter.
Off of Twitter.
I met them, we were on Richard and Judy, me and Stuart Lee. Don't know if you remember him, he's just a bit off the radar a bit. And we were on the same day as the Spice Girls, and the Spice Girls were really excited to meet us, which we were astonished about, because we hadn't really done any TV, but we'd done... we'd hosted a show on MTV called MTV Hot for 2 weeks, and Mel B and her boyfriend watched that, and she rang him up, go, I'm with those guys, and she got me to sign a post-it note, and then she stuck it to her bare midriff. It was very exciting.
It was the Prince of Wales's 50th birthday, I think, and I hosted a show in Manchester and one in London for this auspicious event. It's his 70th, and I know you'll all be incredibly excited about that. And he came to the what they call a lineup afterwards, and the girls were there, and he stopped, and my job was to introduce them, so as I knew their names, and so this is Mel whatever, and this is Mel B, this is Mel C, this is Mel D, this is Mel E. And he said, gosh, you're so famous at the moment, every newspaper I look at there's a Spice Girl, there's a Spice Girl, and Emma said, well, what we're really interested in, is it true that was it your grandfather, Prince Albert? Well, my great grandfather, yes. Is it called a Prince Albert because he wore one? And he said, he wore coats and trousers. He honestly never heard of one. He said, no, the Prince Albert, you know. And he looked at me rather helplessly and desperate, and I said, it's an article of intimate apparel. He went, oh, good Lord, you mean... I said, yes. And he said, well, I don't think so. Is it for men or for women? And I said, for men, I think that's why it's called the Prince Albert. He said, why would this be thought of? I said, no idea. And I asked the girls if they had any items of intimate jewellery on them, and they said no, they didn't have anything velvic. And so I managed to get a joke out of it. So, theirs is obviously due for a cervix. Their vulva.
Prince Charles would be a good guest to have on this. I could just say ask him a few questions. So if you know, you could. I'll get his number after. See if he'll come down. But of course, the Prince Albert is actually named after the son of Queen Victoria.
Exactly, Bertie.
Just trying to get on QI. With my amazing knowledge. Prince Albert's named after Prince Albert. Do you remember it being in Woof? Do you remember the children's show Woof?
Yes. I don't know how you knew that.
I do my research.
Wow.
Didn't mention it in your autobiography, but I think it was a bit like Big John, Little John. It is an Andy Kaufman. It's the son of the Big John. It's the one who looks like Andy Kaufman. That's something from last week, don't worry. They're confused. But Woof is about a boy who turned into a dog.
Beautiful.
So it's
dog.
Very similar to Big John, Little John.
And it starred Lionel Jeffries. That's really why I wanted to do it. Who was in lots of Peter Sellers films, and he's the Caractacus Potts' father in Chitty Bang Bang, P.O.S.H., all that stuff. Wonderful man. I mean, genius. Absolute genius. And he played the Marquis of Queensbury in the Peter Finch Oscar Wilde film. So he was incredibly funny and extraordinary man who just about every other word said cunt. He was 80. And
it made the edit of Woof very difficult.
It really did. It's where we are when you're counting ready. That's what they wrote. It's just then the poor boy that had a chaperone was hidden around the corner. It was the dog. It was fine. The dog wasn't offended in the least, but it was good fun.
Good. Well, look, I've been a mass fan of yours because when I became really interested in comedy was just when everything was exploding around your career and the Young Ones. But before that, I remember Al Fresco, which I was obsessed with. And I hate Brideshead Revisited as a result of this. It was on the same time as Brideshead Revisited.
It was a bit of a clash, wasn't it?
And my mum loved Brideshead Revisited. And this was like, it was only 1982 or 1983, but there were no video players, nothing was ever repeated. And I remember being just so... I'd seen some of the first series. and then it was on the second series. Maybe, I don't know. I'd definitely seen some episodes, but it was devastated that I couldn't watch it. So I now hate Evelyn Waugh. He married a woman called Evelyn Waugh. Do you know that about Evelyn Waugh?
He married another Evelyn.
I know a lot of facts.
They were known as he Evelyn and she Evelyn.
They were. I knew that.
Yeah.
So do you remember? I don't remember much about it. The only joke I remember from Al Fresco was they were doing a Robin Hood thing, and it said, "Will Robin Hood save Maid Marian? Will Friar Tuck eat some food? Will Scarlet's jerkin's looking very nice, isn't it?" And that's the only joke I remember from it.
Well, I originally read the joke when it was such a "See you, Little John, staff all awry. You will jerkin off, you." And they thought that was too strong, so they just changed it.
Do you remember much about Al Fresco?
Well, it was a strange time. We had been so incredibly fortunate. Four of us, in fact, had come from the Edinburgh Festival, where we'd been fortunate enough to win the Perrier Award. It was the first year of the Perrier Award. And it was myself and Hugh Laurie, who, he's a hospital cleaner or something now, anyway. And Emma Thompson and Paul Shearer. And we did the show, and every night, virtually, we did the show, someone popped round backstage. First of all, there was an Australian who asked if we wanted to tour Australia after we did it. And we thought that was a fantastic idea. Mm-hmm. It was the year 1981, where those days it was really rare. We'd beaten the Australians at the Ashes. Now it's a common occurrence. We get bored by it. But, and then someone came from the BBC saying, could they show the show on BBC, the Footlight Show. And we came, this is extraordinary, because we had all imagined. I thought that I'd go back to Cambridge and quietly grow tweed and become an academic of some kind. Hugh had his eye, for some reason, on the Hong Kong police force. he'd read that they were corrupt, and he saw himself as a sort of broom going in there to clean them up, a maverick, you know, in those white creased shorts that they wear, rooting out, refusing to be bribed and so on. Emma, we did know, was definitely going into the business. It was just apparent the moment we saw her she was going to become an actress. And then someone from ITV came around, a little researcher called John Plowman, and then later on began to run BBC Comedy for many, many years, was responsible for all kinds of programmes like AmFab and whatnot. And they asked if we'd do a show for Granada. And we said yes. And they said, we wanted to have you in, but you're like, you know, sketch comedians from, let's face it, the rather traditional end, Cambridge Footlights and so on. So we're going to add some other people. And we found this guy who's just come down from art school in Scotland, Robbie Coltrane. And this guy who's just graduated from Manchester University, Ben Elton. And so we all got together to make this show, Al Fresco. And it was a disaster.
It was good.
Young people like, well, thank you.
I couldn't watch it because Brides had revisited it.
But it was an extraordinary experience. It was our first experience of television. And then at the same time, Ben was writing The Young Ones. And I can actually remember the time being in the Midland Hotel, in a desperate attempt to get into The Young Ones, because the first series had just shown and we thought it was fantastic. And Rick was up there visiting Ben and Rick Mail, and he was like, you know, what are we going to do for the second series? And I said, well, why don't you play a college from Oxbridge, say, at University Challenge? That's brilliant. We'll shit all over you. I said, oh, yeah, well, yes, it could be done that way. And so there was an episode indeed, once they came and, yeah. Basically.
You don't need to tell me, I know all about it. I can remember lots of these. I've just remembered Ironic Monty from Al Fresco. That was a good bit.
Yes.
Ironic Monty isn't buried here.
Yes, that's right.
I think that was Ben. So it's all flooding back to me. But yeah, and I remember, I actually saw the Cambridge Footlights on TV as well, and there was a joke in that, which was, I think it was you and Hugh, but it may not, that might just be my memory, where going, oh, I'm very embarrassed if people who know ask me which university I went to. I don't want to say Cambridge because, you know, I'll be judged. So I just say, you know, I just say we went to Oxford. And I remember really finding that hilariously funny. Then I went to Oxford and didn't find it so funny anyway. I think I just used it the other way around. I think we always used to do that.
The next generation of Footlights, I remember going to see because they're going to see their show, was included in Newman and Badil.
Yes.
And David Badil had a very good thing about being, a little routine about being at Cambridge and having a Jewish mother. He said, you know, my mother is so proud that I've gone to Cambridge, I can't tell you. If I was drowning, she would shout out, "Help, help, my son who goes to Cambridge University is drowning."
Very good. So, and I've been researching you properly, like, because I thought I should do a proper job, because you're like not like Chris Addison or someone like a prop. Properly, I just use Chris Addison as a warm up. So I've actually been reading. I wanted to read both of your autobiographies, but I didn't get time, because I was going to skim this my washbox. I have read this before, but I really massively enjoyed this. I have to say that I think if anyone's got any even just an intellectual or adolescent child, that everyone should read this book, because it's a fascinating story of how you went through a public school but were a slightly naughty boy.
I was expelled from a number of schools, I ended up in prison, in fact, when I was 17, and that
in
was
Pucklechurch.
Pucklechurch,
which sounds like it's been made specially for you. where shall we say that doesn't exist?
We didn't call them prison officers or screws. We called them stewards. The head prison staff was the butler. No, it may sound as if it had little roses around the door, Pucklechurch, but it was actually a very pretty vicious place. And I fitted right in. I'd been to boarding school since I was seven. This was nothing. It was absolutely nothing. And there was a lot of... There was a lot of violence. There were a lot of illiterate children, basically, people aged between 17 and 21, from the Welsh and far western reaches of Cornwall, was its catchment area. And I remember teaching this Welsh boy to read. It was quite... He was to share the cell. So I can't make words out of nothing. And so I slowly started to teach him to read, and I got a job painting little soldiers, which are little enamel soldiers. I'd just do the white crosses on their backs. They were red coats, as in the American War, and someone else would have done the red, and I'd do the white crosses. And then on Sundays, I got the job of playing the piano for the hymns. I'm not a very good pianist, but I can just about manage it, and that was thrilling. And the Bishop of Bath and Wells came to me. And I used to... I know it sounds insane. And I used
to visit, he wasn't being...
No.
Or just there were quite a lot of young lads around.
It was a sweet shop for him. No, he came, bless his socks. And I used to go rather crazy on the end of the hymns. I used to do these sort of classical music arpeggios at the end of it. You know, dum, 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 da-da, da-da. And at the end, the Bishop of Bath and Wells had us all in a circle with the prison officers behind, looking very stern. And he was talking about how Jesus had forgiven us all and everything, and that our lives were certain to be turned round and all this kind of stuff. And everyone was going, yeah. He said, "Now, does any of you have a question for me? Any question you like, really?" And you could see the prison officers going, I said, "Well, my Lord Bishop, there is one thing." And he looked rather startled and said, "Yes." I said, "Did Sir Majesty's prison issue soap?" He said, "Yes." I said, "It doesn't lather, it doesn't float, it isn't perfumed. All it can really be said to do is keep you company in the bath. I wonder if you might be able to do something about it." He said, "Well, I'll pass the word on." And then everybody drifted away. And the prison officer grabbed me by the shoulder. I thought, "I'm in real trouble." He said, "The bishop wants to speak to you." So I was kept back. He said, I know I should never ask this question. Those of us who visit prisons never do it. Why on God's green earth are you here?" So it was a peculiar experience. And then I was, 17 by this time, and I was thinking life was a bit too late, but I thought, if I get out without a prison sentence, because I'd been going all around Britain on someone else's credit card, and I'd stayed at the Ritz and places like that, I had a really fantastic time. It was before... Before the magnetic stripe, you just had to do a signature, and that was it, really. As long as you looked plausible, then it was fine. And I wore these sort of suits and detachable collars. And, you know, it looked preposterous, like something out of Gatsby. But I thought I might get away with a non-custodial sentence, and my parents, bless them, said my godfather, who was a QC and knighted, and this court had never seen anything like it, this huge figure, famous lawyer, Sir Oliver Popplewell. I thought, he's going to ruin it. He's going to be so grand that they're going to say, well, bloody hell, we're going to send him to fucking prison just because you can afford this bastard to come down here like that. But fortunately, he played it very, very meekly. And I got 2 years probation. And in the first year, I went to Norwich City College and did A-levels and got a Cambridge entrance. And at the end of my first year at Cambridge, I went to my senior tutor and I said, I've got something really exciting to tell you. He said, what's that? I said, yesterday, I came off probation. He said, you're on probation? I said, yes, you might want to look at your admission cards and forms, because at no point they ask your schooling, they ask what teams you played for, they ask your interest in theatre. At no point do they say, are you on probation? It was never asked, I never answered. So I got away with it.
You know, it's an amazing story about isolation. I think it just really speaks about adolescent isolation and confusion and confidence, but also, you know, completely. Lack of confidence. It's just such beautifully written. I mean, it's a love story as well, which is very, very touching and beautiful. But, you know, I love this. You wrote to yourself when you were 16, I think, and to myself, not to be read until I'm 25, which is just an amazing. I know what you'll think when you read this. You'll be embarrassed, you'll scoff and sneer. Well, I tell you now that everything I feel now, everything I am now, is truer and better than anything I ever shall be. This is me now, the real me. Every day I grow away from the me that is writing this now is a betrayal and a defeat. And it goes on like that. But I think that's exactly how you feel when you're 15 and 16. You think you do sort of feel, and as an adult you feel you're leaving that behind, and you sometimes do feel you've betrayed
absolutely
something.
Absolutely right. I do feel I've betrayed my younger self. My younger self could have a more emotional response to the arrival of spring or to the sight of a sunset or indeed to love itself and to feeling and to poetry. Had a visceral and a powerful effect on me. There's a line of a CD-old poem, but it's a beautiful line, which is, can we ever hope to recapture that first fine, careless rapture? And it is true, and you just think it is something relatively exterior to one's own emotional life, like music. I can remember hearing certain pieces of music on a wind-up gramophone that had been my grandfather's, and I will never have as great an emotional response to that music, no matter if I paid £20,000 for the finest system or even a live orchestra to play it for me. It wouldn't move me as much as hearing that music then. Because when you're ripe and open to some emotional experience, and it usually is one's teens, then everything floods in and it can never be as powerful again. And so, and if you slightly know it, and I knew it because I was precocious and in as much as I read a lot of books, so I knew from writers that they felt that. So I knew it was inevitable that I would go out into the world, Wordsworth called it the world of getting and spending, and that it would be a lesser world. Than although we're shamed as teenagers of spots or the amount we're growing or whatever else it may be, we know inside that the republic, as it were, the eternal republic of the adolescent, is a kind of paradise compared to the horrific world that we all inhabit now as adults. I think it's our duty to our children and to the young to remember it.
Yeah.
And to cede them that, however peculiar they look, however odd their language, they do feel inside with an intensity, a passionate intensity, that we've often lost.
Yeah, I think so. It'd be a good question to go to an emergency question now.
I'm sorry.
No. I just really like the idea of punctuating that by asking Stephen Fry, have you ever tried to suck your own cock? It seemed like the right moment.
Talking
people
betrayed,
are going out crying, look, they're leaving.
You really want to stay
tears.
For this answer.
They thought we were coming to a comedy show. And look at his chair, I'm going to have to go and
this is not just
crying.
An answer, it's going to be a demonstration. He's still going.
He looks like he could be in the English Defence League, and then he did the most camp little...
I would be very astonished if any man here said they hadn't attempted that act. I'd be very impressed by those who had achieved it. There seem to be two methods. One is the what you might call the forward curl, and the other is the backward somersault. Yeah. Neither should be performed in public. Frankly, distressing. So near, yet so far. I blame it down to the fact that nature, unfortunately, gave me a really short, stubby tongue. I've seen it done, obviously. Tom Dreiberg, who used to be chairman of the Labour Party back in the day, wrote, he was one of the most shocking, scandalous figures of the time. He wrote a marvellous autobiography called Ruling Passions, and he writes, I remember reading this when I was about 15, because I read every single book there was to read that in, you know, one book led to another, like a kind of hypertext link nowadays on the web, was the bibliography. A book would have in the back of it a bibliography, books that were sources for the writing of that book. So I'd go to the library in Norwich with a great list of, and then pull out any book that was anything to do with man-on-man action or anything close to it. And Tom Dreiberg was very famous for having an affair with Lord Boothby, and who was also having an affair with the Prime Minister's wife, Macmillan's wife. It was a very complex web of sexual intrigue back in those days. And he watched Nijinsky do it. And he said it was one of the most primary, beautiful acts he had ever witnessed. This stunningly beautiful ballet dancer, curled tightly. And Nijinsky apparently called it recycling. he said this is much potassium, is very good. So there you are. It is, but there may be men in the audience, and if there aren't any of these who've had this feeling, then once again, I have to feel alone. As you know, the job of the comedian is to express thought and hope that it's one common amongst others. So, you know, like when you're fingering in your own. So that kind of one, when you realise that is just you. But no, this is where you wake up convinced that you've done it. In your dreams, you actually have given yourself a blowjob. You think, that was brilliant. No, it was a dream. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's the old joke, isn't it? Why do dogs lick their balls? Because they can. Anyway.
And I do have some questions. That was very thorough. Thank you. As you expect. I can't wait to ask Mary Beard about that next week.
She's my Mary Beard just does remind me, it's just a wonderful story about the great Kenny Everett, whom some of you would be too young to remember, but who was a magnificent comedian, disc jockey, all kinds of things. Very, very funny. And he got away, he and Barry Crown, he's a writer on his TV shows, got away with the character who's most famous for her owl and the best possible taste, who was called Cupid Stunt. That was her name. And for two series, we said, we really like that. They're the fun, funny one you do. Cupid... Hang on a minute. Oh, no. Cupid Stunt is a... That's a spoon that you can't possibly. For two series, you got away with that, and we're not allowing it. And so for the next series, they changed the name to Mary Hinge. Oh, that's fine. That's fine, yes. Oh, thank goodness you've seen sense. It reminds me in a small way of a thing that happened at the Disney Company some years ago, in the early days of the inter-office email. There was a very stern, from Michael Eisner, who ran Disney, stern memo saying, if any employee of the Disney Corporation is found to have used the phrase Auschwitz of this beloved company, they will be summarily dismissed. Within seconds, people were saying, did you get the memo from Dachau? I just, you know, it's that old truth, you can put chains on them but they'll sing. You know, it's You can't beat the human spirit in the end.
Along with my emergency questions, I have some questions from Ben Evans, who is 12 years old. He's Chris Evans' son. Not that one. No, not the one from the Avengers. The one who from Go Faster Stripe. His son has written me a list of questions he would like to ask you. So I'm going to come back to these as they go.
Okay.
And maybe I shouldn't tell you which ones are his and which ones are mine, to be honest. But why were you the bad guy in The Borrowers?
Interesting point. I think my height might have made me, even in miniaturisation, might have made me quite a small borrower, might a tall borrower.
Yeah.
Also, in the end, when you're an actor, once you get your Equity card, your SAG card, your Screen Actors Guild card, you have to look yourself in the face and be honest. One of my favourite lines, I am to be passionate about almost all films, but I have a very soft spot for the Don Siegel Dirty Harry movies. The first one was Dirty Harry. The second one, you may remember, was Magnum Force. And in it, Clint says, "You're a good man, Briggs, and a good man knows his limitations." And that's the sort of running line of the thing. You're a good man, but a good man knows his limitations. I'm not sure how good I am, but I try to believe that I know my limitations when it comes to film acting. I am not going to get the scripts that Ryan Gosling has just turned down. It's just never going to happen. It's unfair, it's beastly, but there are parts, Nazi Gauleiters, snooty lawyers, pompous judges, and vicious, in this case, scientists, that are somehow more likely to come my way. And it would be stupid to turn them down, awaiting being asked to play the next Bond, because, you know, it just isn't going to happen. So it's realism. And actually, the other thing is it's fun. I did one of my first proper Hollywood movies I did was with... it was an extraordinary cast. It was with Meg Ryan and Tim Robbins, and the fantastic Walter Matthau, who was really truly great, and he'd worked with, you know, Cary Grant. He did the best Elvis Presley movie, Kid Creole, which is just a magnificent film. And he used to hold his shoulders as if he had his, his coat hanger still in. That was his walk. And every time I came into the makeup, he was playing Einstein. He would take my hand and he'd say, "Will you let go of my fucking hand? Jesus Christ, will you let go of my hand?" Like that. And of course, I was just holding it. And eventually, I'd pull it away. "Go, you fucking British, you're so fucking polite. Why do you tell the old man to shut up?" But he was bliss. And he said there was a moment where there was a bit of a going on with the leads. And he said, "You know how fucking lucky you are not to be a star. Have you any idea?" And I didn't really know what he meant, because obviously I thought being a star would be great. It was nice to be in the film. You were treated nicely. And then I did a film with John Travolta. And this was the point where John Travolta was just zoomed up again. After Pulp Fiction, you know, he was getting paid on this movie $21 million, which was $1 million more than the highest that had ever been paid. That was what his agent said. "John will do it for the $20 million that whoever it is got for the previous one plus one." So he was getting paid $21 million. I was getting a fraction of that. I mean, almost not a half. No. and it had in it, it had Kathy Bates, it had William Macy. It had the fabulous, I'm going to forget his name now, which is awful, who plays Tony Soprano,
His name last week,
James Gandolfini was in it, telling me that he was about to do this HBO thing about gangsters. I said, "Ooh, that sounds good."
Does he need a butler?
Exactly. And it was just an incredible cast. And John Lithgow, wonderful John Lithgow, was the judge. There was a big courtroom scenes in it. And there was JT, as he was known. And it was lit by Conrad Hall, Connie Hall, who's considered, you know, one of the greatest cinematographers in the history of Hollywood. He did Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I mean, it was just genius. Everybody on that set was wonderful. And JT was perfectly nice. But he'd have a conversation, and he'd suddenly just disappear. The director would call us all together and say, "Now, in the scene, I want, where's John?" And he would have gone off to JTville, which was like three huge trailers, and a line of motorbikes and golf caddies, and just deciding which way he wanted to go from his area to the set. You know, he'd just, no, I think I'll go on the motorbike this time, you know. And one of the offices was his staff, and one of the trailers was his staff. The other was for his kitchens. He had a sushi kitchen and an ordinary kitchen, and the other was for himself. And so he was looked after. Robert Duvall, who was in the movie, who's one of my favourite actors, you know, played Tom Hagen in The Godfather, won an Oscar for The Apostle. He's an extraordinary, brilliant actor. And he said, you see, what you don't understand, Steve, is we're all in this movie because the director wanted us in this movie and the producer wanted us in this movie. They could cast anybody they wanted. They said, no, we'll have Stephen Fry for that part. We'll have Kathy Bates for that part. But the lead, the studio wanted Jane. And he knows that. He sees us talking together about that play we did. Oh, we were in that movie and we're laughing and we're giggling. He has the whole movie on his back. The studio on his back. If he doesn't make money back, he's a failure. And he's scared. He's just scared because he's a film star. And it's one of those strange things. God, you know, punishes those who whose prayers he answers. I've never met a happy film star. It's honestly true. I've met quite a few because of BAFTA and things. You meet them. The ones I meet who are happier, either those who are, I won't say over the hill exactly, but who don't need to worry about being a film star, Warren Beatty or something, just a relaxed guy, Dustin Hoffman now. Apparently he was a nightmare when he was at his height. I mean, real, real trouble, but now just the funniest. This is, sounds honestly true. Dustin Hoffman, I'm so nervous. It was about the second BAFTA Film Awards I was presenting, and Dustin Hoffman was there. And we were going down the stairs together at the Grosvenor House, and he tapped me on the shoulder and said, I'm really, really sorry. Would you mind very, very much signing your autograph for my daughter? And I said, no. No, that would be fine. And I signed. He said, thank you so much. That's really kind. I thought, fuck, the world has gone completely upside down. I've just signed Dustin Hoffman's daughter's autograph.
Did he stick it on his own sunscreen?
No, he
that's
didn't.
The question. Because unless they do that, it doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah, I know.
And parade around with it like that. I asked one of them that did well. That was a good question from Ben.
Yes,
very didn't expect
good.
It to lead that far.
No, sorry.
I don't know what. No, I'm very glad. This is what this podcast is all about. I don't know what tone of voice to read this one in. Why did you agree to do Thunderpants? that's what I'm guessing. Or it could be, why did you agree to do Thunderpants?
Leslie Phillips, Simon Callow, and Rupert Grint is the answer. I'd met Rupert along with the other kids in the movie, of the Harry Potter movies, and also the director was a friend. And it was one day in a courtroom. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't read the script.
I'm not been a judge in that. Spice World. I can do a judge in.
I'm going to give you another bombshell. Judi Dench doesn't read her scripts. She actually doesn't. She just she has told her agents, says, I think you should do this one. She goes, okay. And she says, I think you should do this one. She goes, okay, I won't. And it's that simple. Fine. It's easy. I usually read scripts. The Hobbit. I'm not sure I should say this, but
go on, say it. This isn't really going out anymore.
I had never read The Hobbit.
Really? Hold on.
Real short.
I wish I'd had that. It's a Harry Potter in the front row. He's grown up a bit. He's got a couple of tattoos. I've gone really out of focus. I think I touched something, Chris.
That's a sleeve. You pull those on. On the flight to New Zealand, which is a long flight, you'd think I'd have time to read The Hobbit.
Yes,
I had it. I'd downloaded it onto my electronic reading device because I'm not allowed to say iPad anymore without people hating you. So I thought I'll read The Hobbit, and something about in a hole in the ground that lived a hobbit. I said, all right, I got the point of that. I think now. Great.
To be fair, it'd be quicker to read the book than it would to read the script, I'm guessing, in that particular.
Then I thought my character was called the Master of Lake Town, and I thought, oh, There's a lot of this. There's a search function, so I just put in the master. I just went to all the bits that I was in. I said, oh, that seems a reasonable part. And put the iPad down and read another book. So to this day, I haven't read The Hobbit, but I'm really looking forward to seeing how it all turns out. I'm sure it'll be wonderful.
It'll be another 15 years before the final part's out, though. It was good. What they put Tim from The Office in it, which is always that's the second best thing you can put in a film, Tim from The Office, and it'll be fine.
The first being Benedict Cumberbatch, of course.
Well,
no, he's you.
No, well, I'd be. You know, no one asked me to do film, Steve. If you could put in a word, that would be
good. All right.
I tried to call him Steve there. I'm trying to get away, just trying to get it more and more casual. Anyone ever call you Steve?
No, very rare. Americans.
Hey, Steve. No, it's, you've got to put a I have a running joke about putting a Shrek. I'm trying to run it into the ground and destroy it. Now, it's one man laughed at him. But I tried to. You know, when you get a successful catchphrase, you kind of want to destroy it fairly quickly.
I find to do that.
It's like I love in Wayne's World. The second one in Wayne's World. They have one of the executives, one of the uncool executives, going, "That's really good." Not.
Yeah.
And it's like by the second film it's already uncool to do
utterly
to
nah. Yeah. It's like when your mother says, "No, that was tits of maze balls." Oh mother. Please.
Your mother said that.
She had a go.
Oh. What is now this isn't an emergency question, this is my deep research. What is your favourite pinball machine?
Oh my goodness. That's going back. I mean, obviously now you can have them on your electronic portable tablet device.
Not as good.
But originally, there was one in the Students' Union of the Norfolk College of Arts and Technology, which is one of the... I think it was after the third place I was expelled from. And it's... I can't remember what its theme was. They always have a theme, don't they?
Well, I kind of got into pinball machines in a big way in the kind of late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And they'd become slightly computerized as well.
Yes, there was sort of not.
But I liked the Addams Family pinball. I don't know if you ever played
so
that
good
one.
Addams,
but
that
was the Addams Family pinball.
Oh.
I thought there'd be more pinball fans in the audience. But yeah, there was one about the old one. The first one I ever played was in France, and it was based on Kiss, the rock band Piss, I was going to call them. That would be even better. And I got a credit, and I was on my school trip, and I think I got the high score in it, and none of my.
That sound when they rack up the thumb replays is the most beautiful sound in the world.
It's fantastic. Though you also did get picked up by a guy in a pinball.
I did here in that's not my favourite necessarily.
No.
But here in London's Piccadilly.
Yeah. I never got picked up. I remember once a man was watching me playing. They used to have one in the bottom downstairs in the Virgin Megastore, which is gone now, on Oxford Street. And I remember a very nerdy guy, and I was walking around London quite lonely and at the time, and I didn't know what to do, and I was playing Addams Family pinball on my own, and this guy was watching and put me off, and I told him to stop watching me, and he walked away quite sad.
Oh. Thought,
that was my chance to make a friend playing pinball. But then having read your book,
so
I'm quite
much
glad
further as well. mine expressed his friendship and a desire to know me more by putting two 10p pieces on the machine. And I said, "Oh, it's fine, I've got a couple of replays." He said, "No, they're for you." I said, "Oh, thanks very much." He says, "Fine." So I like watching people playing pinball. And I sort of innocently thought, "That's not sweet." That's really sweet. So I played nothing. No, I've run out. He said, "Oh, never mind, let's go and get a drink somewhere." I said, "Okay." And he said, "Well, come think about it, I don't live that far away." So innocent.
To be honest, two credits on Addams Family Pinball, I'd have gone back with him. I only needed one. And my wife and I came to see, I'm married. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Really?
Yeah, I'm married.
Good Lord. Well done.
Thank you. It took me 45 years, but I got married.
I'm very impressed. That's wonderful.
I had to test out a lot of the different women to get the best one. But not that many. But we came to see you in Twelfth Night.
Oh, thank you.
But unfortunately not at the Globe, which I love going to see things.
Globe is fantastic.
Because it makes you really appreciate what the Shakespeare plays really are. I think you're playing to the... Just playing to the proles and doing the asides. But I've written you a Malvolio, which is one, it's one of my favourite. I think I should play Toby Belch. I want to play Toby Belch.
Oh, you'd be a wonderful Toby Belch.
I tell you what I think would be a great idea, and that wouldn't be me playing Toby Belch, having watched it again, was the Muppets should do Twelfth Night.
Fantastic.
And I think you should be Malvolio in it, but when you know, like when they used to do the Treasure Island and those were the best films.
Scrooge. Yeah.
One human being having to. It's Michael Caine's best role. Yeah. I genuinely think he has to act against Muppets, and when you have to act against Beaker, going and then you're looking at him.
Brings out all your resources.
It's just you kind of think this guy is an amazing actor. I think you as Malvolio, and then all the. Fuzzy Bear as Feste, Toby Belch.
Miss Piggy, Olivia, obviously. Yeah. We are taking it to America in a few months. We're going to do it.
Get rid of Mark Rylance and all those shit.
Right.
The Muppets. Get Kermit in there.
On Broadway, you think it would do well? It might do.
I think it would.
We'll start off with Mark Rylance, and if he's not going well, we'll ring for the Muppets.
I love this play, but my fascination with this play, it goes quite deep into the play. This might be boring for you, just tell, and you at home. I'm quite obsessed with the character Fabian.
Yes, how interesting.
In the because he doesn't appear until halfway through the play,
like
Act Two, Scene Six, or something, whatever. And he suddenly is a friend of. Belch and Ague Cheek.
Yes, he's a sort of.
He's not explained where he's coming from.
He has it against Malvolio because Malvolio once reported him for cockfighting or bear fighting or something. So he joins in the revenge. And in. I don't know if anyone knows the play, but essentially a love letter, apparently from Olivia, the mistress of the house, is left lying on a bench and Malvolio is wandering along, practicing his own behaviour to his shadow, as the phrase has it, because he's a very pompous figure, and yet they cast me. And he finds this letter, and it's very cunningly written by Maria, the sort of maid of the house, as a revenge against Malvolio. And it makes it look as if it's from Olivia. And he reads it out, and he realises Olivia, his mistress, is in love with him. And he's so excited. And concealed in the little box tree are Maria and... not Toby Belch, is it? It's Andrew Aguecheek and this chap, Fabian, who's just made his first appearance.
Just appeared out of nowhere.
And previously, when they're setting up the plot, Maria says... so Andrew shall make one of the three and the fool can make the other.
Yeah.
And there is a fool, Feste, the clown. And so my only feeling in it is that Feste has quite a long role and he was the actor Richard Armin, who was a very important part of that set-up, the King's Players, as they were about to become. The Queen, it was in the Queen's last year they performed it. They were the Chamberlain's men and then King James came down from Scotland. And... he basically said, this is too rustic a part for me. It's not very funny just sitting in a bench, sitting in a beechwood tree all day. Get someone else to do it. And so they said, basically got someone else to do it because the next scenes are full of Feste singing and doing long, long things. So I think it's just... I mean, there are a few errors in the play, you could call them errors, which are... You only notice when you've performed it about 50 times, which I think shows that Shakespeare knew what he was doing.
But Sebastian says he doesn't know that Viola shares the same birthday as him and they're twins.
That's well spotted as well. He says, that's exactly the day that my father died, when Viola made her 15th year. So did I. They're identical
unless
twins.
She was born like 5 minutes to midnight and he was born at 5 minutes past midnight.
Wow.
I think that's what Shakespeare was thinking.
This is really true. There is a significant aristocrat, if you can have such a thing in the 21st century, only in the sense that he owns an enormous amount of land and a large number of houses, and it's a very important title, and has with it the right to carry the white stick at the opening of Parliament. It's an important marquisate, and he had recently twins. Not only that, they were identical twins. Not only that, they had to be born by caesarean section. So the doctor, is it that way or that way? Maybe it's that way. The doctor does the slice and opens up the lady's opening. And there are two babies. The first one to be pulled out will become the Marquess, will be worth hundreds of millions of pounds, will own the houses, Scotland, the castles, you know, everything. And the second one will just be called, you know, Lord Richard, and own nothing, because that's the way the aristocracy works. So how do you... Well, that one looks a little bit smarter than that. No, maybe not. And then it really was down to the first one that was pulled out.
Yes.
If you put that in a novel, you'd be ridiculous. That actually happened.
I suppose it, you know, nature has its own way of deciding which one comes out first. It's still just
but
a lottery.
Not with a cesarean section. Well,
no. Yeah.
Yeah,
no, it's a very interesting point. It's good.
Thank you.
Didn't expect to go there. Fabian has the best line in Twelfth Night as well.
He really
I'm
does.
I'm a big fan of Fabian. I want to be Toby Welch, but I might play Fabian one day. If this were played upon a stage now, I could condemn it as an improbable fiction.
Yeah, it's the best line. It's a very good line, isn't it?
It's kind of a postmodern.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's good. You're gonna have to watch. So can we get
this? Were two comedians. If this was on a podcast, as if it were two comedians talking,
yeah.
I could honestly say that was an improbable fiction.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like saying that.
It is like
saying that. Better.
I think we're better. I think we could do it better. He wasn't all that good at jokes, Shakespeare, but that one's not too bad. I was going to lead somewhere there. I'll jump to an emergency question while I try and think where my train of thought was going. People will want to know this. I'm bored of this question, but people will want to know. If you had to choose between a hand made out of ham or an armpit that dispensed sun cream, you're only allowed one of those two things. A hand that's made out of ham. You can ask any specific questions before you jump in and make a decision.
Right.
It's made of ham. You could eat it if you want it, and it will grow back.
But only right.
Slowly. Probably if you ate the whole thing in a month, if you just had a nibble, it probably a day or so.
Yeah.
So you could have a little... And it would still function as a hand. You could choose which hand it would be. I'm not going to force you to...
Right, okay.
David Mitchell pointed out it probably would leave a residue, a sort of meaty residue on everything you touch. Slime. But the way we do that as human beings, we do leave a slight residue on everything.
Epithelial.
Or an armpit that dispenses sun cream, you'd sort of do that, and whenever it would come out when you wanted, there'd be some kind of catch on it that would flip across, and you could have sun cream, but not unlimited. It's not like Willy Wonka. Something Willy Wonka would invent. It's like a normal amount of sun cream that your body would produce, but enough to keep you in sun cream for probably the summer.
I just so want to know really about your mind. the questions are interesting in and of themselves, but nothing like as interesting as the mind whence they sprang. I will go with the sun cream. I mean, both my hands are useful to me in all kinds of ways. And
imagine
to have
one
them
of them
crumbly,
was that would have some extra
bread-crumbed bits of fat on the end. Would they go off?
I think as long as it was on, you know, if you chopped it off and left it somewhere, it would go off.
My mother's Jewish. I think she'd object.
Yeah, there is that. I think you are the first.
Don't bite your nails. God will kill you.
I'm sure the Jews have something about sun cream in there somewhere. They have most... If you look in Leviticus, there's something about no sun cream when you're menstruating.
It's mostly foreskins that they're obsessed with. I don't know why people quote the Bible as being against homosexuality. It makes three glancing references of no particular savagery, but foreskins. My God. Any of you in here with a foreskin, God hates you. He really does. You're in trouble, such trouble. Did you see what George Takei did? The wonderful Mr. Sulu, the original Mr. Sulu, who's been married, civil partnership to his fella for some years, and is an active gay campaigner in America, and I've been fearless about it, which is what's so wonderful. And there's these churches who put these God hate faggots things up, and there was one who was holding up a huge one, which quoted Leviticus about it being an abomination. And Takei went up to it and said, "We may burn in hell, but your daughters will be sold as slaves. You are wearing two types of wool." Which in Leviticus is a terrible sin. And your daughters can be sold as slaves. Your daughters can be sold as slaves almost any infringement. And you can rape the daughters of your enemies. All these things are welcomed in the Bible. But just three little references to a little bit of flesh on flesh. And anyway, don't get me started on that.
No, I'd like to.
Really?
I thought that was part of the payment.
I'd thought of having Grindr on in this room and just seeing if there's anybody.
I was kind of thinking, because as I was reading your book, and I think you were talking about how, because you're quite an interesting Englishman, I think, and I think you're kind of, you always said it's a quintessentially English, but I think you sort of are quintessentially English in that you are the grandson, at least, of immigrants,
yes.
of Jewish immigrants,
yes,
but you're quite traditional. You sort of say you want all the pomp and ceremony of everything to survive.
Cricket,
but then you're not a Luddite. You're very into the future and technology and changing, and obviously you're gay, and that's you're very kind of liberal in those views, and that to me seems much more English than, you know, because England is a nation of immigrants. We're completely made up of immigrants, and it's and I kind of, as I was reading your book, I was thinking, if we were to change the political system slightly, I think you're right, keep it as it is, but you, Stephen Fry, become essentially a non-elected president, right, of the United Kingdom. I think everyone would go with this. And basically everything operates, it's sort of a bit like the role the Queen used to have, or the King used to have. But basically a law is passed by Parliament, they come to you and they say, is this all right? And you go, yeah, or no. And whatever you say,
you just haven't read it through.
And whatever you say is what happens. But everything else goes first. So you can't say, I'm going to make it a law.
No, don't give me absolute power, please.
But they'll come to you with their laws. And David Cameron will say, shall we allow gay marriage? And you, I'm guessing you'll say yes. But
is this a complicated way, David? Just come out and ask, David. Yeah. You don't have to dress it up in frills. Cameron is an amigran of romance.
I think that will work. And then when you die, David Mitchell can do it. It won't be as good. But it's
it'll be more logical. Yeah. So that means... Oh, so if you're saying that...
I would like to see that. Now, I do have to take issue with you about your fine novel, Making History.
Right.
I enjoyed the novel, but if you were listening last week, one woman over there was, I was talking about the film Sliding Doors, which I do not like.
It's not my favourite.
In fact, I would go as far as saying it is my worst film I've ever seen. Wow. And I think in Making History, you make a similar mistake to they make in Sliding Doors.
Which is?
This is the worst thing you can say. This might be the worst thing.
Is it an anomaly?
I'm very into time travel. I'm very interested in time travel based fiction. If you in Making History, without giving too much away, they find a way to go back and poison something that was
a spermicidal pill.
Yeah,
in the water supply of Brunau in Austria,
so that Hitler's father won't be able to have Hitler.
Yeah,
but then they come back, and so the things are quite different. That's right, but a lot of things are. Similar, and all the people are the same. None of those people will be alive, Steve.
No, hang on. I think you might have missed.
Change one thing in history, certainly if Moscow gets, or St. Petersburg gets bombed, nuclear bombed.
Yeah.
Then all the population of the Earth will be different from in 50 years' time.
Not in that many generations.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Different people would meet up, different people would get married, spermatozoon would get through.
There are differences. There is the old saying, if you go back, a million years and kick a stone, you'll come back. The whole history of the world would be different. And there's a famous Ray Bradbury story about a time machine which is controlled by scientists who have to wear special suits, utterly clean, and they only come out on a little electric gangplank, and they're allowed to look at historical events but cannot, of course, interrelate or interfere with them. And one of them goes out who studies dinosaurs, and he looks carefully at the dinosaurs, and his suit is completely sterilized and everything like that, and his gangplank zooms back into his machine, and then he presses the button to go back to the present and notices on his shoe there's a butterfly. He's trodden on a butterfly. And he gets back and things are different. There's a different president, there's a different system. The letter E is written backwards. And he goes slowly mad because he's changed the way. Yeah. He can't predict how the world has changed. Things are very different. But this...
Everything would change straight away.
The point of the book is not a science fiction book. It's this. Is that I grew up with my mother saying... No, no, no. I grew up, it's called making history. No. And I grew up with my mother. Well, she first showed me a big photograph of all our family when I was about 9 or 10 or something. And I said, where's he and where's she and where's those cousins? And she said, well, Hitler killed them. And of course, when you're a child, you think, literally, I picked up Hitler with a dagger, stabbing them. And then you learn of the awful truth of the Holocaust. And you think, how could that have been stopped? And we easily say, yeah, it was Hitler, it was Hitler, it was Hitler. And I started reading lots of books about the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe. And in the 1890s, there were over 20 regular anti-Semitic publications in Vienna alone. And there were two listers of known, THULIST and pan-German organisations of extreme right-wingery. And they were rather halted by the war. And lots of people, of course, fought in that First World War. And then after the First World War, the Dorfschuss, you know, the stab in the back, Dorfschlag, the stab in the back, you know, the reparations we made the Germans pay, the poverty they had and so on. And the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the party became the Nazi Party, was one of literally scores of parties. And it just so happened, for various historical reasons, that Hitler's rose above the others. Now, all I wanted to think was that if it was not really even a time machine, it was just the ability to send a molecular structure back to a particular place at a particular time. So this scientist sends a spermicidal pill into the water supply. And all that means is, really, that the whole village of was unable to have babies for quite a long while, one of them being Hitler, who was never born. But of course, there still would have been, after the First World War, huge numbers of anti-Semitic, right-wing, fascistic parties that would have got together and would have beaten the communists and would have come to power. And the one mistake, ironically, I say the one mistake, the biggest mistake Hitler made, it really was gigantic, if you want him to win the war, were the Nuremberg Acts, which disallowed any Jew from holding academic tenure anywhere in Germany. And all the inventors of the atom bomb, all the physicists and mathematicians and engineers, really, almost without exception, who were behind, as you know, were at Göttingen Institute and such other places, Heisenberg and so forth, were German Jews. And so they left Germany. And they went to America, where they worked with Oppenheimer on the Manhattan Project. And Germans were left, Himmler himself said that Jewish science was fake science. He refused to believe Einstein. So they went down the deuterium oxide route, as you know, the heavy water route. They thought heavy water would be the answer to an atom bomb.
It was nuclear physicist.
Yeah, exactly.
We always have him here any nuclear physicist stuff comes up. Everything all right so far? Yeah, okay.
You can't teach an old dog nuclear physics. So imagine you had a smarter, it's a horrible thought, but a smarter leader, one who wasn't quite so fanatically anti-Semitic in Germany. He might have been rather anti-Semitic. So he would have some of the Jews that were still alive, the ones who were sort of Hitler's age, or just older than Hitler's age, who would have been all the Jews, you know, plenty of the Jews, the scientific Jews, were younger than Hitler, so they'd be alive, and lots and lots of them, and he would get them to work on a bomb. And by the late 1930s, the Reich would have had a nuclear bomb, and America wouldn't, and they would be absolute rulers of the world. And then he would turn his attention to the Jews, and he'd think, look at all these bloody Jews, and we don't like them, we want to kill them all. Why don't we use that strange water we found in Brunau that makes men sterile? We'll make all the Jewish men drink that water. So the awful irony is that the sending of the water, it sent a magic water, which scientists had tried to analyse, and they'd found a spermicidal pill, so he could wipe out all Jews in one go without death camps by making them drink that water. Now, that's, as it were, it's a way of saying almost, we're better off having had Hitler, which sounds mad. It sounds bad, but we are where we are now, for good or ill, and there was a huge amount of ill. But don't for a minute assume that if that particular egg hadn't hit that particular sperm, or the other way around, I believe it's the sperm that does the work, but you know what I mean. Don't assume that that history would be wonderful.
No, of course.
But
yeah,
everything would be different. The minute you've changed anything, anyone who wasn't alive, that my grandma would still be alive unless you got killed in one of the atomic bombs or whatever. But anyone who wasn't alive, the minute you've changed, every meeting changes,
there are no Jews alive when he comes back. There are literally no Jews.
But the character still is alive, and he wouldn't be alive, I don't think. Maybe you would in the time frame. See, it's a small. All I'm just saying is, you know, it makes the same mistake that Goodnight Sweetheart makes, and it's just not something that I would want put on my gravestone, and it will be on your. If I outlive you, yeah. It will be on your gravestone.
Star Trek.
I'm just going to write in Tibex that it was killing it, making history was good, except, and then I'll write an essay about that. It's a good book. All the books are good. You've got to read. They're all fantastic. And you can't sing.
No, I certainly can't. Nary a note.
But you could sing when a hypnotist made you sing.
Well, it was a peculiar thing. I had to sing. Every week, back in the 80s, in the early days of Channel 4, they used to do a series called Saturday Live, or occasionally Friday Live. I can't remember. It changed its name according to the date of broadcast, pretty obviously. And it was live. And my colleague Hugh Laurie and I would write a sketch, and we'd perform the sketch in front of the audience every time. Ben Elsmith hosted, and it's where Harry Enfield made his name. He did his wonderful kebab shop owner, Stavros, in it, and loads of money and so on. And Hugh and I did our humoresque sketches, and one of them, on about a Tuesday or Wednesday, we were putting sketches together. And it was, we quite liked it, but I suddenly said, "No, hang on, this means I've got to sing." And he said, "Yes, you'll be fine." I said, "No, but you know, I can't sing on live on television. I will freeze up. I will absolutely freeze." He said, "No, you won't. No, you won't." And I said, "We've got to change. We've got to find a new sketch." He said, "Well, we're doing the rehearsal tomorrow with the crew." And I said, "Oh." And then he said, "Go and see a hypnotist or something." I think he was joking, but I went to the Yellow Pages, and there was a Hungarian. Which I just thought sounded, you know, more likely. Laszlo or something or other. So it was in Maddox Street in the centre of London. So I made an appointment and I went to see him. And he said, "And what is your problem?" And I said, "Well, my problem is I can't sing." He said, I want you to put a hand on each knee. And you're feeling already, aren't you? It's fascinating that the flesh of the hand is melting into the knee. It's becoming one, and you can close your eyes now and feel as your no difference between your hand and your knee, and you're now being lowered down a well, and you can see the round light that's coming through, and it's getting smaller and smaller, and it's getting darker and darker until you're really in the complete dark, and only my voice is here with you, and now you're going to tell me what it is that is your problem." And the thing is, I'm aware of it, but I'm also aware that I am in a trance. It's a very strange feeling. So I say, I can't sing, and tomorrow night, live on television, I have to sing. He said, why do you think you can't sing? I said, I know I can't. My father was a chorister at St. Paul's Cathedral. He has a glorious voice. He's a musician, and I love music. And whenever I try and join in, people tiptoe away, and I just know that I can't hear. I can hear that I'm not singing even. He said, "Then when was your first memory that you couldn't sing?" And I said, "Well, it was I was 7 years old, and I was sent away to a prep school in Gloucestershire, and we used to have this thing called Cong Prac. What is this Cong Prac?" And I said, "Well, I think it means congregational practice, and it's on the Saturday you prepare for any of the hymns on the Sunday." So I said, "Yes." And I was singing away. It was my first term, and I was very nervous. I was 200 miles from home, and I was seven, and I was a bit shy. And I was singing this hymn that I didn't know. And a boy stopped and said, "Sir, sir, Fry's singing flat." And I didn't know what flat meant. And what happened next? He said, "Well, the music master said, 'On your own, Fry,' and played the music. And I started to sing, and everybody laughed. And I went very pink. I suddenly became Hungarian. I went very pink. And I had I had completely forgotten this episode. I mean, I'm no time for, you know, a lot of these memory regressions that I was once Cleopatra's handmaiden in previous lives, but I do think you can remember things in your own life that you might have forgotten under hypnosis quite clearly. And he said, so that is the reason, then, that you have this fear of humiliation when singing. He said, I'm going to take this away from you. So next time, when it is tomorrow, you have to sing. I said, yes. He said, what is the, how do you say in English, the words that lead up to what you say, the cue? Yes, the cue. What is the cue for you to have to sing? I said, well, my friend Hugh says, hit it, bitch. And he said, hit it, bitch. And I said, yes. He said, so this is what is going to happen tomorrow. He said, tomorrow you might think you're nervous, but a part of you knows that it's all going to be fine, because when the moment comes and your friend says, hit it, bitch, all the fears will disappear, and you will lose yourself in the music, and you will sing happily and lustily and in tune. He says, now my voice is a rope, and it's going to pull you out of the well, and you can see the light growing at the top, and I'm pulling you out, and pulling you out, and pulling you out, and I will count backwards from 10, and then you will be awake. And so I sort of woke up, and I said, that was fascinating. I said, and he said, do you remember what we were speaking of? I said, yes, I do. I remember the boy's name was Kirk as well. It was the name of the prefect. It's really extraordinary. So I go back and tell Hugh this story. I had dinner that night, and he said, great. He said, I wonder if I should change the cue line. You change that cue line, I will stab you in the neck. But anyway, it's there. Somebody sent it to me. I don't know if it's on YouTube or whatever it is, but somebody actually sent it to me when I told this story later. And there is you saying, get your pitch, and I do sort of sing. But if you want me to sing now, you'll have to call up Hugh and get him to say down the
side. He has to be Hugh saying.
I think he's in Minsk or somewhere, okay. doing his blues album. No, I think he's just back in England, actually.
I'm a bit worried that people listening to the podcast might now have been hypnotised, because that is, if they're listening on the audience, kill David Cameron. Kill, now when you hear hit it, bitch, kill, you'll kill David Cameron. So what's it like having a double act partner who goes on to be much more successful than you, even though everyone knows he's nowhere near as good as you are, and you're clearly the funny one? What is that like?
Let's call him up and ask him. I don't want to sound over soppy, but the beauty of the relationship that I have with Hugh Laurie is that I can say this in all honesty: I love him, and I think, and I know he loves me. And whenever we're ill or unhappy, we comfort each other. I'm godfather to his three children. I have always known he is a simply inexplicably great talent in all directions, aside from his musical gifts and his acting powers and his comic genius. He is, I can honestly say, the wisest man I know. He has a phenomenal gift for insight into things. And if I have a problem, a sort of logical problem or a problem of life problem, I will ask him advice. And he is simply extraordinary. And his wife is probably my second best friend, which makes it even happier. And his three children are incredibly
good friends. Your third, fourth, and fifth.
Yeah, I know. It sounds ridiculous. We spend every Christmas since the children were born. The oldest child is now 23, and he's never had a Christmas, not at my house or ones we've had together. So it sounds all corny, but fortunately, we never ever had a row or any trouble.
Do you think he could get me the phone number of 13 from house? Because
you do know she's lesbian.
Well, that's all right. The character. Are we talking about the character or the actual woman? I don't mind.
Character, sorry.
Well, she's bisexual, the character.
She is.
So that's ideal.
Isn't that isn't that Olivia Wilde?
Yeah, it's Olivia Wilde.
I've got Olivia Wilde's number if you want it. Yeah.
She's engaged to someone else.
She is, yeah.
But, and I'm married to someone else. But the beauty is, me and my wife have we'll have five celebrities that we're allowed to have sex with. And the thing is that you can't usually meet them, but I'm one step away. Olivia Wilde is, including my wife, the most beautiful woman in the world. No, including my wife. She's more attractive than my wife.
Your wife is in some senses more in the audience.
She's very sexy, and it would be. I think we get excited. I do. I mean, if she could stay in character, because I kind of fancy. I've got my five R.
But you've got Louis Walsh in the audience.
It does.
Look, see, there's Louis Walsh.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, there. Let's get him on there. You know, a lot of celebs come along. There he is. That's Louis Walsh there. But with his wife. That's a surprise.
Yeah. she's turned so far away.
My five are. She's got good ones as well, but she'll never meet them. And my five are. When it changes, I like Amy Pond, but the character of Amy Pond. I don't want to go out with the actress who looks like a nightmare. So if she, obviously, I will have to. The actress will have to be involved, but I'm prepared to have sex with her, but only she'll stay in character for the whole
time. Fair enough.
Anne Widdecombe is my second one. Because I thought, you know, I like a challenge. And you know, it's quite difficult to find a virgin these days.
That's true. But I think the whole point of Anne Widdecombe is that she should stay a virgin and be a bit of a shock for those suicide bombers.
I can't decide. Olivia Wilde, either as 13 or probably as 13, I've said, but I think she's going out with some bloke from Saturday Night Live now. So she likes comedians.
Yeah.
And after this podcast, I'm going to be divorced. So it's just step by step. We're getting close. She likes Sawyer from Lost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, do you like Sawyer from Lost?
Yes, I know.
But, you know, I think I've got a little, you know.
You've got that look.
I'm a little bit there. Yeah. Brad Pitt's copied my look. He doesn't pull off.
Well, as I do. Women most like in men is wit and money and charm. So surely she's got to love Tyrion, Peter Dinklage from the Game of Thrones.
Do you like? Would you like Peter Dinklage, Katie? He's
Tyrion Lannister from Game of Thrones. They call him the Imp.
He's nice. He's on my list. Amazing. I'm going to put him on my list as well. Yeah. I've got a couple of spares at the bomb.
Well, yes, because he only counts as half, so you can know. I think that's fair. I have a 5%, as I call it, which are women.
Okay.
That there are certain women that I just go, yes, I absolutely.
Which women do you go for? Anne Widdecombe?
No, Anne Widdecombe.
Come on!
Amazingly, is not on that list.
If you did a celebrity sex tape with you and Anne Widdecombe, that would go what? That would go ballistic.
I sort of did the equivalent of debate on the Catholic Church with her that counts. This won't mean anything to you, but Rowan Atkinson's wife, Sinitra, is definitely one. And Nigella Lawson, I know that's obvious, but I really would, I think. I think she's. And if you don't know the others, but I just think
you can't have your mates' wives. No. They've got to be.
No.
That's going to lead to all kinds of trouble. It's got to be celebrities. I know it's a celebrity's wife, but it's different if you are a proper full-on celebrity
because
they all meet each other. You're posh and a celebrity, and those are the two basically groups that just fuck each other regardless of what social contracts have been. I met Jonathan Aitken when I did I did a program where I had to did an Oxford Cambridge boat race with celebrities, of which I was one and Emma Kennedy was one, which shows you the level we're going. So Toby Young was one, and Jonathan Aitken was in it, but he was too old to row. So and everyone else was I was the tallest of the other celebrities. I'm 5'6½.
It's and all John Jackson, no.
But Jonathan Aitken was our cox, so we had a 6-foot-tall cox and loads of tiny little rows. So we did compare ourselves to Lord of the Rings. In fact, as we were playing, but his life is very, very.
Jonathan Aitken, yes, indeed.
In fact, it turned out that his daughter realised someone at school looked quite like her. It was the daughter of Khashoggi, the arms dealer.
By her own father.
Yeah, and she said, we're very similar, aren't we? And then they realised eventually that Jonathan Aitken was...
Whoa.
Was, I think that's common knowledge.
Oh, good.
I don't think he told me. I bonded a little bit with Jonathan Aitken. I've never seen him again since, but when we won this Oxford-Cambridge boat race, and I hugged Jonathan Aitken, which is not something I ever thought would happen, wearing spandex, which is something else I never thought would happen. But it was interesting. I'll ask you another of Ben's questions before I forget. This is a great question. What is it like being Stephen Fry?
It's a very hard question to answer.
It is.
If I answer in a negative way, it sounds ungrateful, because I have had an extraordinarily fortunate life. I've been able to do an enormous number of things that most people don't get the opportunity to do, in terms of travel, meeting people, occasions, things. You know, I get invited to ridiculous, would you like to drive a Formula One car, and all that sort of thing. And I kind of have to pinch myself occasionally. Oh, it's another invitation to the Royal Box at Wimbledon. Should I go this year or not? You know, and I think, come on, you're lucky. There are people who would give anything for this kind of opportunity. Another part of me, and I've made this boringly plain in television programmes and other things I won't wank on about, is that I am the victim of my own moods, more than most people are, perhaps, inasmuch as I have a condition which requires me to take medication so that I don't get either too hyper or too depressed to the point of suicide. I go as far as to tell you that I attempted it last year. So that I'm not always happy. This is the first time I've said this in public, but I thought I might as well. I'm president of Mind, and the whole point is, in my role as I see it, is not to be shy and forthcoming about the morbidity and the genuine nature of the likelihood of death amongst people with certain mood disorders if they don't look after it, if they think they can do without the medication or the regular visits to a doctor and without taking care of themselves. And it was a close-run thing. I took a huge number of pills with a huge number of vodka, and the mixture of them made my body convulse so much that I broke 4 ribs, but I was still unconscious. Unfortunately, the producer I was filming at the time came into the hotel room, and I was found in a sort of unconscious state and taken back to England and looked after. Now, you may say, how can anybody who's got it all be so stupid as to want to end it all? That's the point. There's no why. It's not the right question. There's no reason. If there were a reason for it, you could reason someone out of it, and you could tell them why they shouldn't take their own life. And some of the most brilliant minds there have been have taken their lives, writers, artists, and people who are not particularly famous but are wonderful people. I like to think that if I had children, I would think harder about doing it, but I know people who have children who've done it, or did know people who've had children who've taken their own lives. Sometimes it's the expression I imagine on my mother and father's face, both of whom are alive and happy, that stops me. But there are other occasions when I can't stop myself, or at least I feel I can't. And you may say, well, that's what friends are for. You talked about Hugh, and why didn't you just call him up? And all my friends, when they heard about this, and family, when they eventually heard about it, said, came to visit me in the hospital, said, why didn't you call? And I said, it's a very odd thing, but put it this way. It's a cheap and silly way of putting it, but it's just as true. Think of your very best friend, your very, very best friend. And suppose you suddenly noticed you had a massive and really disturbing genital wart. Would you show it to your very best friend? No. No, you might show it to a stranger, a doctor, a genital urinary specialist, or to Dr. Christian, I suppose, on embarrassing bodies, or an Indian street, in his case. But the weird thing is, although friendship is what Ralph Waldo Emerson called the masterpiece of nature, and it is a thing we all celebrate, oddly enough, it doesn't solve things like that. So although it's terrible to bring the conversation down, what it's like to be Stephen Fry is a very mixed and peculiar thing. If unmedicated, there are times when I'm so exuberant, so hyper, that I can go 3 or 4 nights without sleeping, and I'm writing and I'm doing stuff, and I'm so grandiose, I'm so full of self-belief that it's almost impossible to deal with me. I can't stop speaking, I'm incredible, I go on shopping sprees. Fortunately, one of the common signs of mania, or hypermania as it's known, is sexual exhibitionism. I don't have that as one of my brands, but others do. But I do have shopping. I remember once going into Bond Street, and I came back with a taxi with something like 17 shopping bags, and I put them in my bedroom, and about 3 days later I sort of switched phase into the depressed, and I came out of that okay, and then realised that I hadn't opened any single one of these shopping bags, and I threw them all away. Well, I just left them out in the street. I hope someone picked them up. But I left them out in the street. And there may be some people in the audience who can relate to this and others who know people who have this same issue. And I know there are plenty of, for everyone who is sympathetic about it, there'll be some Melanie Phillips who say, sort of, why don't they just walk it off? You know, honestly, it's just some celebrity designer disease. When I'm conscious, when I'm rational, I realise that being Stephen Fry is a very wonderfully happy thing to be able to be. People are extraordinarily nice to me. That's the thing that I honestly most get out of it, is the average cab I get into, or the person who stops me in the street is not just, oh, can I have a photograph, but they really say nice things, because of books or whatever, they say nice things that maybe relate to their own children or to their own lives, which makes one happy to have made a difference. Mostly it's great. But there are times, and I don't know if you've ever had this, Richard, where you're on stage. I spoke about this in the Manic Depression, when I'm doing QI, and I'm going, and the next question. And inside I'm going, I want to fucking die. I want to fucking die.
Well, yeah, it is weird that you have to carry on regardless of what's going on in your life and what you're feeling. I have certainly had lonely times and depressed times, and I think like I went through depressions not on any level of the same as that, but throughout. I think because it's a difficult job because you're high and low. Yeah. For me, I'm on stage and I've got like voices in my head going, "What if you forget how to speak now? What if you forget how to form letters? And you know, and there's what if you just forget what's coming up next? Yeah, and there's a kind of evil voice in my head trying to throw me off.
Yes, which, I know that. I did the Sydney Opera House. I've somehow agreed. I don't have an act. I'm not a stand-up comedian. I don't have an act as such. And I was doing Literary Festival in Hong Kong, and then I was going down to New Zealand to start filming on The Hobbit. And they said, would I do an evening at the Opera House? And I thought, well, it's on the way, virtually. I might as well stop off at Sydney. And so I said yes. And I was wandering around this nice hotel that looks right out across at the Opera House, and thinking, 2,000 people, it's going to be really good fun. And I thought, but what am I going to say? I literally don't know what I'm going to say. And I was so astonished by my complete lack of preparedness that I started to find it funny. So I eventually ended up in the wings of the Opera House, and there was a room right night. You got your yeah? I said yeah. I said, how are you going to signal the interval? I said, you'll know when it's... You'll know. I came out and I literally said, ladies and gentlemen, they were very kind, I suppose. I said, it's wonderful to be here. I want you to know that it's perfectly possible that in any minute my mouth may open and close like a guppy and no sound will come out of it at all. And you are all entitled to your money back. And they all kind of laughed. And then I asked someone if they had an iPhone. And I said, can you set it to timer? And in 40 minutes, give me a wave. And then I just talked. And I Christ knows what. And the extraordinary thing is that they'd sold it out so much that I had to do the second night in the Opera House as well. And then if you've ever been to Australia, you'll know this. Melbourne, of course, will not tolerate someone from Britain being in Sydney and then not going to Melbourne. So they set up a Facebook page demanding that I come to Melbourne. So I hired a theatre in Melbourne and did that twice. And Phil McIntyre, whom I'm sure you know, is a promoter, does a lot of comedy. He calls me up somehow in Melbourne and says, so, you've got an act then? And I said, well, I don't know if it's an act exactly, but I've got away with these four performances. He said, seven. I said, what do you mean seven? I bought the Albert Hall three nights for you. And that's it. And to this day, I don't know what I said in any of them. It was different each time, and I don't really know what it was. But.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you have that. When I do a new Edinburgh show, which I'm doing now, I'm just working. Well, I've got my first preview on Sunday, and I've got no idea what I'm going to say. So the first few shows are kind of like that, though not usually, admittedly, in the Sydney Opera House.
Here's a good opening joke for you.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, I was in the attic. And I found an old sex offenders registry in the attic. It was extraordinary. I thought, what's that doing there? It was a TV Times 1973.
Well, I'm slightly annoyed that Ben's questions are getting much, much better answers than mine every single time. I'm worried if you do kill yourself that me tip-exing the plot problems with making history are going to look a bit sick when I desecrate your grave. So I hope you will look after yourself.
I'm genuine at regular medication. I've succumbed good. And it seems to be working.
No, but you know, I mean, everyone really end. Fucking loves you. But it's a very important thing. I think we can call it a day. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. To my room guest, Stephen Fry. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my special guest, who's only bloody Stephen Fry. How did that happen? The music you're listening to is by Pest. It's got quite a nice beat, hasn't it? Thanks to Orange Mark and the PH Comedy Guide, and to Go Faster Strike, Chris Evans, not that one, and all his minions from Wales. His nameless minions who will never be named. This was produced by Ben Walker. It was a Fuzz, Go Faster Strike, and Sky Potato production for the internet. Hooray! How do you like them Sky Potatoes? If you've enjoyed listening to this free podcast, then you have many opportunities to reward me and the people here who are helping me by buying some stuff elsewhere. You can buy the video of all the podcasts at gofasterstripe.com/podcast, where you can also buy lots of my DVDs and books. If you want to get some payback that way. I'm also doing a new show called We're All Gonna Die, which is at the Edinburgh Fringe, all the way through August at the Pleasance Beyond at 8 o'clock. You can come to see that. You'll get a free DVD and a free programme if you come to that as well, because I like giving stuff away for nothing. And that's about it, isn't it? I don't know what else is going on, Ben. Anything? No, that's it. So if you... No, next week. Next week's guests, very important, are John Lloyd, the producer of QI, Not That I Got News, Spitting Image, Blackadder. He's worked in everything. He was the original host of I Got News For You. He's amazing. And also Mary Beard, the classicist, archaeologist, and TV presenter. A very fantastically funny woman and very interesting. It'll be a very proper... It's going to be a very intellectual show next week, and there will be no rude questions because I have to impress my intellectual guests. So tune in next week. Pay some money for something, you cheapskates. Bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And, would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.